You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 245 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of, we'll go back to it, the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. You can't take that away from us.
You definitely can't take that away from us. We have a lot to cover this week. This is supposed to be our down season, and it is not.
We're not quite at down season yet. Just wait till we're in February.
We'll get to down season, but we're not waiting
that
for that to start.
That kind of sounded like a threat.
Oh, we'll get to down season. But we're not waiting for that to start our search for Seattle's best chicken.
Hello.
And there's so much more. I am going to mount two defenses of unpopular things in this podcast.
Wow.
Not one, but two. So let's get into it right away, starting
that
with
sounds
this
almost biblical. By the time the end of this podcast strikes, Kevin will have mounted two defenses of unpopular things.
I guess that does. By the time the cock crows, I'll have mounted two defenses of unpopular things. Let's get into it, starting with our beer. We're going back to our friends at Fremont Brewery and the Atomic Hazy IPA. A little bit about the Atomic Hazy IPA.
You have to note that it's a brewery-only release, right?
Sure.
For exclusivity.
Oh, yes. Aroma of pineapple, mango, and other tropicals, along with citrus, vanilla. The hops, Mosaic and Brew One hops. And the flavor is moderately sweet and light bitterness with medium mouth-watering body and carbonation. I feel like that's not that notable. Like, if you have a beer that doesn't include carbonation, that's going to be a concern. Have you seen the new Fremont logo?
I don't know if I have. Is it on this can?
It is not on this can. Okay. The new brand was rolled out this week, but it's on Twitter and Instagram and on the website. So
it's a time for changes.
If you can look at any of those things, I learned looking into this. So as we learned at one point on the podcast,
I actually did notice that on Instagram earlier, and I was like, "What is that?"
Yeah, that's the new brand identity. As we learned on a previous Pelton cast where I was confused about the identity of this bird, it's a heron. And do you know why it's a heron?
I don't know.
It's because the great blue heron is the official city bird of Seattle.
Wow. Hello.
I learned that from some of the Fremont marketing materials, and then I went and looked up the other official symbols of Seattle. Did you know that the city of Seattle has an official flower?
The city of Seattle, the state of Washington. City of Seattle is an official flower.
Yes. This is not like when Almost Live was trying to get Louie to be the official state song of Washington.
Okay. That doesn't seem far-fetched at all anymore. It actually seems quite normal now that baby boomers control all of government. We'll get there. But anyway,
I don't know if it's boomers that were put into power here.
The greatest generation.
The dahlia is the official flower of Seattle, and the two official city slogans are the city of flowers and the city of goodwill, neither of which have ever been used.
Really, that's just informative is what that is, you know. It's not an interesting podcast, but it is informative.
That's what we're here for. It's really a public service that we're doing. All right, we start off with a toast.
Fourth grade book report.
Okay. I don't know why I think that every report you write in fourth grade starts with the person was born on this date in this city. We start, obviously, with a toast to the inauguration of Joe Biden is our 46th president, and Kamala Harris is vice president, a historic and momentous day.
Hello! I am drunk off Rainier beer and high off democracy. Let's go.
You said you wanted to do a let's Wait, remember some before inaugurations.
That, I've got a story. I have got a story.
Oh.
So, as one does, I gathered my family around this evening for a toast to the end of the Trump presidency. We also toasted to the Bernie meme, of course, as we do when there's a good meme that goes around. I gathered everybody around, and I decided to give a little toast. And I said, for the first time in Babyist Fantasy Genius's life, Donald Trump will not be the president. And in chimes, little fucking Kevin Pelton over here, Baby Fantasy Genius, and he was like, actually...
When he was born, technically.
When he was born, Barack Obama was technically the president. And I'm like, Luca, I'm spinning a narrative here, right? This is for the journey. You're worried too much about the facts. It's about the story itself, right? You know what I mean? Nobody cares about tossing the ring into Mount Mordor or whatever. You know, the Mount Doom, right? You care about the journey to get there. And that's what I was trying to point out to Luca, but he had to get his baby Kevin Pelton on and correct me as I was giving a toast to my family about the inauguration of Joseph Biden. But I thought we'd be remiss.
First off, I want to say, I think it's very important that Baby Fantasy Genius is... you know, taking on this role because I can't be there to correct you 24/7.
But I thought we'd be remiss if we didn't do on this day that only happens once every 4 years. And a day that we only celebrate once every 8 years as of right now. A little bit of let's remember some inaugurations.
I mean, the thing is, there's only one inauguration I really remember at all, which is 2009.
Oh, obviously. That's the one that you're going for. Hello. See, I
Wait,
thought
were
you were going
for 4 years ago?
No.
Well, where were
I
you
I was
going?
Going for the Lord's year 1993.
You really remember the 93 inauguration?
This is, it's like the most important inauguration of our lives because of the Inauguration Day storm. I just wanted to get where you were during the Inauguration Day storm. I thought you had memories of this because I was a little bit too young, but I thought you would remember this very well.
No, I got nothing for you here.
You got nothing on the Inauguration Day storm?
I got nothing on that one.
Wow. All right. Then screw the whole thing. I mean, you could tell your 2009 story, I suppose, but like, come on. I swear we got sent to school. And I think that they predicted that this would start. I was 7. How do you not remember this? This is... Baby Fantasy Genius is going to remember this inauguration when he's...
It's been replaced by sporty event.
If only the Sonics would have played that day. I think we got sent to school, and I think we knew that a storm was coming. And if I remember correctly, I think we preemptively got sent home early from school before the storm could really hit on Inauguration Day 93. And I remember our grandpa, this couldn't be true because I remember it only being me in the car and not you. And we would have been going to the same school at the time, right? In 93?
Correct.
You wouldn't have been out of Valley View yet. No. So that this must have been a different day. But I remember getting into our grandparents' Cadillac, of course, and counting to 100 and being like, I can count to 100, grandma and grandpa. And counting to 100 straight with them being like, okay, you need to stop. And I really thought that was the exact same day as the 1993 Inauguration Day storm. I can't believe you don't have memories of this.
Well, the bad news is Baby Fantasy Genius is going to bust in to tell you that your story is wrong. The Sonics did play that day.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
The Lakers lost to the Supersonics. Hello. 111-101.
It was
26 points from Ricky Pierce. Shouts to Big Paper Daddy. My only real... like Inauguration Day memories is in 2009 watching it that was when I was working for the Storm and we were temporarily in the old Sonics and Storm practice facility, the Furtado Center, that winter before moving to new offices in Inner Bay after the Sonics move. And so I remember everyone gathering around in like the, you know, it's kind of like a lounge, kind of like living room area upstairs in the Furtado Center and watching on TV. So there you go.
Nice. Well, if any of the listener out there has any recollections of the 1993 Inauguration Day storm, please share with us.
So that's been Let's Remember Some Inaugurations, which we mostly didn't remember, as it turned out. Continuing our toast to Seahawks GM John Schneider, who agreed last week to a 5-year extension, taking his deal through the 2027 NFL draft. Yeah, I mean, this wasn't terribly surprising. I actually thought the most interesting aspect of this was that it was announced on Twitter by Seahawks vice chair Bert Cold in just his fourth tweet ever. Cold, a longtime trusted confidant of the late Paul Allen, is also executive VP of sports strategy and operations at Vulcan Inc., the company that is the parent company of the Seahawks, has been heavily connected to Blazers moves in the past, but don't remember him being this prominently involved on the Seahawks side before. So,
okay. Well, what a power move by John Schneider to have convinced the Seahawks that there was actually a chance that he would take the Detroit Lions GM job. It's like,
staying in the Seahawks.
We all knew that was not happening when it was rumored.
Yeah, definitely not as appealing a gig. Staying in the Seahawks front office, farewell to former vice president of football operations Scott Fitterer, who was hired by the Carolina Panthers as their GM. Fitterer, a Seattle area native and Kennedy High School grad, spent 2 decades in the Seahawks front office, working his way up from the college scouting department, was the co-director of player personnel from 2015 through 2019 before assuming his most recent title and effectively assistant GM duties.
Hello! The most famous Kennedy grad since Jim Caviezel.
Still Jim Caviezel. Definitely more famous. Also Sam Heward.
Shouts to the, not the Highland School District, but the Seamount League.
Yes. Yes. Our arch rivals back in the old Seamount League. We're also pouring one out this week for Philip Rivers, who announced his retirement on Wednesday. Retires 3-1 in his career against the Seahawks, including 2-1 at Lumen Field. And 2-0 against Russell Wilson.
God, Phil Rivers, an unstoppable force. I think the game that the Seahawks beat Phil Rivers, if I recall correctly, they really crushed them in, like, I want to say 2010 or so.
It was 2010, yes. They didn't crush them, though. It was a one-touchdown game.
It was a game that I don't think I remember being there, and I think me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius went. I think it was the first ever Seahawks game that she went to. But I remember being at that game and going into it expecting to lose and the Seahawks winning.
Wow, this must have been a thrilling game. The Chargers tied it, a Rivers touchdown to Antonio Gates, and then a 2-point conversion that he converted with a pass, tied the game at 20-20 with 6:39 left. The Seahawks got the game-winning touchdown on the ensuing kickoff, Leon Washington going 99 yards to win the game.
Wow.
His second kickoff return for a touchdown of that game.
Kind of wild that I have no recollection of either of those kick return touchdowns.
Man, I don't remember this either. I wonder if it was opposite like a Storm game because that was the Storm's championship season. So.
Love Phil Rivers, though. Always love Phil Rivers.
Yeah, Russ is never going to get a chance to beat him. I mean, QB wins are not a thing, but Phil Rivers definitely owned the Seahawks. The last thing we wanted to mention is a toast this week. A toast to the listener, Elliot Allen, for putting together a cheap beer taste test inspired by our version of that coming back on Twitter, brought up by Third Pelton brother Chris Smith, who was the winner of that cheap beer taste test. Inspired by, well, you were not the winner, because on the very second or third episode ever of the Pelton cast, you claimed that you could distinguish Coors Light when you were, we were debating the merits of Coors Light for whatever reason.
Do not check the tapes. Do not go back.
No. You claimed you could distinguish it from other cheap beers. I said you couldn't, and then we did a taste test with 10 cheap beers, 9 cheap beers, and we threw in Ziggy Zaggy Lager as a control to kind of tell, and we both rated them for quality and tried to guess them, and Ziggy Zaggy was the only one you correctly guessed out of those 10, including Rainier.
First off, if Mitch Levy thinks the audio quality of Randy's Zoom is bad, he should not go back and listen to early Pelton cast.
No, definitely not.
And also, I personally think this was an unfair ranking because there were two different factors that were at bay. not only were we judging for taste, we were also trying to figure out which beer was which. And I think trying to do both of those things makes it very difficult to focus in on either one. And you're trying to be like, well, I think that's Rainier, so I'm going to try to rank it higher or whatever, because there's too much societal pressure at bay instead of just taste. So I think there should be two separate taste tests if we ever do this in the future, which we should do this in the future. And
first off, we did this while tailgating for a UW game. So hopefully we can tailgate for a UW game at some point in the distant future.
Yeah, or another sporting event. We'll get
is that you not wanting to go to UW games? I was talking about the pandemic.
I'll be happy to tailgate. I think we do two different taste tests. Or we do one if we feel like we need to do this, where we try to guess the beers, an exhibition of skill. And then another one where we're actually ranking them by taste.
I don't feel like we need to prove anything. You might feel like you need to prove anything. I beat you in the
you're retired.
The competition. So.
I choose not to drink.
Well, we did when we talked about this.
Oh, Lord.
Vow that we were going to do it again in the future and then just have never done it again.
We imagined at the time as doing all sorts of different beer taste tests.
It was great, though, because I bought 10 different six-packs of cheap beers and had them all in my fridge the night before the game. Good times. Well, instead of testing beer and trying to figure out which is the best cheap beer, we've obviously moved on to our searches for Seattle's best food. And it's time to commence our search for Seattle's fried chicken, but not without a fair bit of controversy over what exactly constitutes fried chicken. The listener has spoken, and the listener seems unanimous, not only that chicken sandwiches shouldn't count, but also there is a lot of contention that chicken strips or tenders should not count. Including, we have your favorite, a listener email. Entitled from.
I like them less when they're specifically related to chicken.
Entitled, Chicken Sandwich is Not Fried Chicken.
Wow.
Do what you want, but no way a chicken sandwich is fried chicken. You wouldn't judge the best steak in Seattle and put in cheesesteak sandwiches. You wouldn't judge the best shrimp cocktail and add shrimp tacos to the mix. Fried chicken has bones in it. You can't put boned chicken in a sandwich. Chicken tenders aren't fried chicken either, unless you are also counting chicken wings, chicken nuggets, chicken fries, orange chicken, and all other forms of chicken that are prepared via frying. Fried chicken should be the thing in the menu that is in the fried chicken part of the menu, original or spicy, not on the sandwich part of the menu or the chicken wing part or the fried rice or katsu part of the menu. Fried chicken is only one battle in chicken wars. In no way was it ended by a lame-ass chicken sandwich, which I can't. You lost me that the lame-ass from my own. Have some self-respect.
No. He's talking about Wendy's, who said that they ended the chicken wars. That's not a Maono issue.
I see. Have some self-respect and give fried chicken its due. For the record, I usually agree with Tristan's hot takes, but this is just an excuse to eat chicken sandwiches and shirk your holy duty to deem the best food in Seattle. Never run on first down, and Godspeed, Pepe.
Wow.
Now, the chicken wing issue was one that Third Pelton Brother Talking Taco Time co-host Randy also brought up on Twitter is, well, like, if chicken sandwiches count, why don't chicken wings count? And clearly chicken wings are not going to be part of this search.
I have no answer for this. I don't know. It's a complicated search, but we've already... Both of us had chicken tenders from the first location.
Well, chicken tenders are undoubtedly going to be part of this. I mean,
okay. Sorry,
to me,
Pepper.
They are in the same family.
Chicken sandwiches out. Okay, so here are the rules as you've established them, right?
So we are ruling out chicken sandwiches?
Chicken sandwiches are done forever. Gone.
Wow.
We can have a conversation about chicken sandwiches, but they are not part of this specific search.
I mean, I
Does
think
that
that's
seem
the,
fair?
I think that's the appropriate cutoff because, again, chicken sandwiches were eligible for Seattle's best sandwich.
But we didn't really thoroughly go through chicken sandwiches. I think what we do is we have a conversation about chicken sandwiches. They can be part of the conversation, but they're not what we're judging it on. In a way that, like, if we're at a burger place, we talk about the fries, right? You know, we're talking about everything else, but we're still judging it for the burger. And if we go to a location that has a chicken sandwich that we want to eat, we eat the chicken sandwich, but we also eat tenders and or bone and chicken.
I mean, part of the issue here is, I got to say, the thing about searching for Seattle's best fried chicken is bone-in fried chicken is not my favorite thing. I definitely prefer boneless chicken of some sort. And I mean, to me, it'd be like when we talk about the chicken and waffles at Screen Door, no one would ever say that's not fried chicken, even though it's a boneless breast.
It still feels like fried chicken.
It's clearly prepared in the form of fried chicken.
I think we have to go with a I know fried chicken when I see fried chicken rule here. And I think that the Screen Door chicken is fried chicken. But a chicken sandwich is not.
I mean, it is fried chicken, but it's a subcategory of fried chicken.
Exactly.
And it falls into multiple phylums.
I mean, I'm down to have the search be widespread and sprawling where we're judging all sorts of different things, but I think that may get confusing at some point.
And we probably should do chicken wings as a separate search at some point in the future.
Okay, so we're ruling out wings completely.
100% ruling out wings. They're a different category.
Okay.
They're a different animal altogether.
They're literally the same animal as far as I understand. Right?
Oh, no. Okay, they are the same animal, yes.
Yes.
We're beginning our search with a place that was part of the search for Seattle's best sandwich with their chicken sandwich, and that we've discussed a couple of times, I think, during this stay home period, where I've said that it's been one of my revelations of this period in terms of my level of enjoyment, and that's Baka Bak. So Baka Bak first opened in White Center in 2016 to huge lines initially.
We went there within like the first 2 weeks or so.
Maybe first month. We went to that brewery that no longer exists there.
Oh, that brewery's gone?
Nah, it's been gone for a long time, which is a bummer.
RIP to brewery in White Center whose name we do not remember.
Yeah. I mean, if we remembered it, it might still exist, or vice versa. They have since added locations in Burien. Capitol Hill is part of the Numos complex, which we enjoyed before one of our live Pelton casts, or at least I did, and the U District. Here's how they describe their Korean style fried chicken. It's air dried, hand dripped, and double fried to order. This process isn't fast, but it makes for super juicy chicken with an unforgettable crunch. It's fresh, never frozen, antibiotic, and hormone free chicken. It's the best fried chicken we've ever had. We hope you think so too.
Well, and I think so. We both had tenders from Baka Bak, right?
Correct. As I mentioned last week, I went with the same order, or not last week, the last time we talked about Baka Bak a few weeks ago, I went with the same order, which is I think they describe it as a rub of the chicken tenders or something like that. And I went with the adobo or the, no, I'm sorry, the fish sauce version. What did you go with?
I want to look that up. So I had the barbecue on it, just kind of like the straight up tenders. And then I wanted to look up the exact verbiage of this. As I load their menu, I think it was the OG, and then I just had barbecue as the sauce.
Yeah, so they've got just kind of the straight up strips as an option. I mean, there's so many different versions of chicken that you can have there, but they've got the straight up strips, but there's a separate section where they've got the sauce on them as opposed to just as a dipping sauce.
Yes.
And that's where the fish sauce is an option.
So this was fish sauce caramel that you had?
Yes.
Under wet wings, but you got those as strips.
It's a recent addition to the menu, this particular part of it. And yes, it's not listed on the menu that they show on there.
So you could get the chicken itself with a barbecue rub on the actual fried part of the tender.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You have to go look up what the other options are.
I mean, I can read them right here. So you could do the OG, which is what I had, the barbecue rub, the four alarm, which is really spicy. Supposedly it comes with an 8-ounce carton of milk, sea salt and vinegar, and then coconut brown butter. You seem perplexed.
I'm trying to load the web, the DoorDash page for it, but I have to set it to pick up. So your options, what did you list, Ian?
I listed all the dry wings, the OG, the barbecue rub, the four alarm, the sea salt and vinegar, and the coconut brown butter.
Yes. Yes. Those are the options. Wait, no, those are still the wing options. Baka Bak chicken tossed in signature rub. I guess it is the same things.
I don't know if I really grasp that.
No, it's broader. It's barbecue dry rub, Chinese mustard, coconut brown butter, fish caramel, a four alarm dry rub, sea salt and vinegar, spiced honey and garlic, or jalapeno cheddar dry wet rub.
Okay. You're basically re-saying all the things that I said. You just added some of the wet rubs.
Yes.
But when you repeated the words that I already said as if it was a new word.
I knew that there were more in there because you only said the options. There's four options on the wings and there's like eight options for the rub, for the
well,
strips.
Anyway, delete all this. But I think most importantly, coming back to that point where they describe it as super juicy chicken with an unforgettable crunch, I think it's kind of true. And
I mean, that's the appeal of Korean style fried chicken. I mean, is that contrast.
When you see the video of them on the site, like dipping into the batter, right? It's like a thick amount of batter that they have on there. And the chicken itself is some of the moistest chicken tenders that I've ever had, which I think is a huge element. And then there's a crunch, but not too much of a crunch to it. And I think it's finding that perfect element, because there are some times where it's like you don't want it to be crunchy, but you just want like a little bit before it gets into the soft and juicy chicken on the inside. And I think they kind of hit both near perfectly.
I would say if there's something that the Baka Bak chicken is lacking, it's that the breading itself is not typically spiced.
Okay, like, so that's what I was going to ask you about. Because that would have been my concern also. I didn't know if that was just because I had the OG, though, and I didn't go with any of the rubs.
See, even is a rub, the fish sauce was basically more like a sauce. It just was on there as opposed to something you dip on it. Dip in, I should say.
It would be the only question that I have with this chicken. Really, you know, I'm a little bit hesitant because this is the first location that we've been to. You know, it's tough to give it the highest reviews or whatever, but I don't know what could have been done much better here, to be honest.
So is this a legit contender to you for Seattle's best fried chicken?
I mean, it's option number one, right? It's the first place we've been to.
You've had fried chicken before in your life.
You know, who knows what I've had? after these people are litigating it.
You've had chicken sandwiches before.
That I'm pretty confident I've had. I think it's a legit contender, absolutely, though. You know? I mean, that's what we're here to find out, right? We haven't had the June baby Sunday dinner, right? Like, that's a question. Do I feel like we're going to go into this and at the end of it say Baka Bak is better than that fried chicken? From the hype, the answer is probably not. But at the same time, I think for what Baka Bak is attempting to do, it's near perfect.
Wow. Okay.
Do you disagree with this?
I don't. I mean, like I said, it's been one of my favorite places to go throughout quarantine. I think that's probably more because of the dirty tots, which are than the chicken even. But I do think finding the fish sauce strips has upped my opinion of their chicken game as compared to the chicken sandwiches that I traditionally got in the past. But I was probably never gonna eat again. Yeah. I was going to go pretty conservatively on the rating just because I know that I have a tendency to rate everything too high and then I have to give everything the same rating.
Like that's my concern.
Five
also,
things get a 92. So I was going to come in here pretty conservatively with an 85 for Baka Bak to start this.
All right. I'm going to give it an 88.
All right.
You know, I can see how other chickens could be better. And I think the thing that I want to express is for what Baka Bak is going for with this chicken, I don't know how they can make it better because there's different different chickens for different occasions. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the best chicken in Seattle, but I think as it is prepared, it is the best it can possibly be.
As we look ahead to next week, we're going to consider the national category because you multiple times in the past week have been to Popeyes.
Hell yeah, I have.
That's going to be your inauguration day memory when we talk about this in 4 years. It's having Popeyes today.
You know we're still going to be recording this podcast in 4 years.
Well, I mean, assuming the Sonics let me by that point.
Oh, Lord.
Maybe it'll be strictly food. Do you have an idea for what we should do next week?
Nope.
All right, I'm going to throw something out here that I think we should do because I have been eager to get back since I went, and you have not gone. I alone reviewed this on the pod a couple months ago, and that's Mangosteen.
Oh, okay.
In the International District. I thought, we talked about this at the time, I had the chicken sandwich. I thought it was the best chicken sandwich. I don't know if they do strips. Actually, we got to make sure that Mangosteen is actually eligible, I guess, before I promise this. Because I know they do wings, and I know they do chicken sandwiches. No. And neither of them may be eligible anymore. No. Yeah, it looks like they're not,
oh,
I guess.
Mangosteen.
Wow. You ruined it. I was so excited to go there.
I mean, you could change this. You could. That doesn't really feel fair to be like, well, if they don't have fried chicken or chicken tenders, then the chicken sandwich is eligible. I don't think that makes sense.
Yeah, it's probably not the right precedent to set. All right, well, I guess we'll figure something out and maybe post about it if you want to eat along with us. But Popeyes, definitely you can try out Popeyes.
I want to do a local chicken and a national chicken, at least for the first handful of weeks here.
For sure, yes.
And I mean, I think for those, we definitely talk about chicken sandwiches because, look, the chicken sandwich is popular. You know, it's popular at both local restaurants like Mangosteen, like you're talking about. And I think it's become the signature item at a lot of fast food when we're talking about chicken. So I agree that it is a bit of a slippery slope to go into it and say that something like a chicken nugget would count and chicken wings, those feel a little bit different. And a chicken sandwich does feel different than chicken tenders and fried chicken, bone-in fried chicken.
All right, well, we're off on our search for Seattle's best fried chicken. Stay tuned as we have 7+ months of this to go. It's time for our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because I had Pagliacci Pizza this week, and it was tasting excellent, as always. Went and picked up Pagliacci from the Columbia City location. I got in the car. I was like, I'm not that hungry. And then I sat in traffic driving down Rainier and proceeded to eat like 8 slices of pizza, one after another. Because it was that exact perfect temperature for Pagliacci, where it's not, you know, I think Mitch actually mentioned this on
the
Peltoncast, where you do, sometimes pizza can be like mouth blisteringly hot. And it had cooled just enough that it was at the perfect temperature where the cheese was like just the exact right amount of melted and warm. And I was just like, I have to have another, and I have to have another. So I had a half and half pizza that Mrs. Fantasy Genius and I shared. I had a PSR, and I ate the entire half of a 17-inch pizza.
I'm looking forward to going soon. It's been too long.
I ate 8.5 inches of pizza on that drive home.
On the NBA expansion front, Commissioner Adam Silver and several team owners participated in a seminar Tuesday presented by sports business website Sportico, and King 5's Chris Daniels recapped some key quotes from Silver, standing out among these two. Ultimately, the main driver for expansion should be the ability to grow the pie, not necessarily to sell equity to bring in cash now as opposed to generating the money later. I don't say there are other significant issues around the pandemic in that related to expansion, and that it doesn't feel necessarily like the right time to be diverting our attention to expansion, as we're just doing everything we can to work through the day. And second quote, Some have speculated that's a reason to expand right now, the losses due to the pandemic. As I've said, it's not something we're looking to do in the middle of a pandemic. On the other hand, there are real cash needs for many of these teams right now. It's one of the reasons that people often would sell equity in an enterprise, because they do have cash that they need to invest in an ongoing business by virtue of bringing in those these additional funds.
These feel like completely contradictory quotes.
They certainly are a little bit. I think that Adam Silver is being very careful with his words right now. And the right time to be diverting our attention to expansion. And it's not something we're looking to do in the middle of a pandemic. I think that those phrases are intentionally chosen.
And what do they mean?
It's what we talked about last week on the pod, where there's not necessarily the same level of momentum that we thought there was 2 weeks ago for expansion. And in particular, it doesn't seem like the timetable is going to be as quick as it was. But it's still very much Adam Silver not closing the door on expansion.
Why do you think the tone on this has changed in the last couple of weeks?
I would be speculating on that. I mean, I think one possibility is that there's not, you know, an agreement from a consensus from the owners that this is the right time to expand. But I do think, again, this timing aspect of, you know, people bring a lot of attention to it right now while they're having to deal with the fact that games are repeatedly getting postponed because of players testing positive for COVID-19 and the contact tracing that's associated with it, that it's not the best time to be thinking about, to be talking about expansion publicly, that once they get through these darkest days of the pandemic in terms of playing basketball, that it will become more reasonable for them to consider.
I mean, I suppose that makes sense. Like, Adam Silver has fires burning right now that he needs to put out. And, you know, this has been, I think, probably the most, this has been the most trying couple of years of Adam Silver's tenure as commissioner.
Without question.
Not even just because of the pandemic and how they've handled it. In general, I think the NBA prior to this current NBA season handled it better than almost any league did. And now they're in a situation where time caught up with them. You know, some of the positivity that they had that maybe the NFL or the MLB didn't get last year.
It actually was the tests were negative, not positive.
What?
Positivity, positive tests. It's a joke.
Just delete that too, for your own sake. But these are both, you know, with the conversation around protests in China and going into the pandemic, Adam Silver has faced real issues as commissioner. And I do wonder if maybe some of the steam that was happening, again, like you were saying, this is just speculating, if part of it was trying to push maybe some of the owners who weren't quite at the yes expansion moment just yet. Obviously, you have a lot of small markets and you have a lot of big markets in the NBA. You know, that's how the league itself is structured, probably more so than any of these other leagues. And I would venture to guess that many of the small market teams wouldn't mind the influx of their portion of $2.5 billion at this, especially because that doesn't get shared with the players. Which, you know, we can talk about whether that's fair later on, but I think that it could be he's speaking to both parties here. When we say that this is these are contradictory sayings, it's like, hey, I hear the half of you who are saying, let's go out there and get that $2.5 billion. And I hear the half of you who are saying, well, we don't want to shrink our piece of the TV deal as it comes up the next time, because that's another large chunk of money that they're splitting. So I wonder if it is Adam Silver himself should be a vessel for what the owners want, more so than just necessarily trying to push through his own agenda, and has these two different factions of ownership groups that are out there that are kind of not waging a war, but having this conversation right now ongoing.
Yeah, and I mean, it's premature to think that any conclusion has been reached by anybody anyway. I think that, you know, it's...
Now, the NBA went public with that information earlier. Like, this was not... ESPN didn't make up these stories.
ESPN doesn't make up stories as a general rule.
But I'm saying this was an intentional conversation that was happening around expansion. Adam Silver, he didn't stumble into the city of Seattle hearing about this.
No. And another thing that's happened is Tim Leiweke at Oakview Group continues to be very public about, you know, the pushing this message to the league. So he's not backing off the idea of expansion in any way in the past week. So I don't think anything dramatically has changed.
Okay.
All right, quick Mariners note. Mariners outfielders Julio Rodriguez and Jared Kelnick ranked number 3 and number 4 in Baseball America's annual top 100 prospect list released this week. That list also includes 3 other Mariners, pitcher Logan Gilbert at number 35, 2020 first-round pick Emerson Hancock, another pitcher at number 57, and shortstop Nuelve Marte at number 71. So Mariners farm system looking promising.
There we go. For the first time in a long time, the Mariners farm system is looking promising. I can't wait for all of these players to develop into superstars.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what happens with the Mariners development system. The Mariners way. Yeah. All right. Some big news for the Sounders this week. Jordan Morris, a loan to Swansea City, reportedly in the works. The Swans spent 7 seasons in the English Premier League before being demoted to the Championship after the 2017-18 season. They finished 6th in the Championship table last season and lost in the semifinals of the promotion playoffs. They are currently 2nd in the Championship standings, which would assure them of promotion if maintained. The top 2 make it outright. The next 4 teams play for a 3rd spot in the EPL. Swansea 4 points clear of 3rd place with 22 of 46 matches remaining in the championship season, which is even longer than the MLS
Jesus
schedule.
Jesus Christ. Well, they're going to have to compete with AFC Richmond in that in that season for promotion. So watch out, Swansea.
Swansea, owned by an American group led by Steve Kaplan, a former minority stakeholder in the Memphis Grizzlies, who we talked about this on the pod, whose shares were bought out by Robert Pera as part of a buy-sell option in 2018. The group also includes Jason Levien, who is the CEO and general managing partner of DC United. And so if this deal was completed, a 6-month loan would take Morris through June ahead of the Gold Cup this summer and obviously the end of the championship season.
Okay, let me ask you a real question here.
Yes.
Is this the end of Jordan Morris on the Sounders? At least
most
for this
likely
time being.
So I think the conventional wisdom here is it's a bit surprising that he would decide to go out A, on loan as opposed to being, you know, transferred to another team, and B, to a second division team as opposed to one of the bigger clubs that, you know, he's been linked to. But
what are the bigger clubs that Jordan Morris has been linked to?
I think Fiorentina might have been one of them. Definitely some talk of German clubs. He trialed in Germany previously, so that seemed like a reasonable destination. It seems like the likely scenario here is this is an opportunity for Morris to go over and play a lot right away, you know, get that exposure, have a chance to score goals and show that he can play in Europe. And then if Swansea is promoted, potentially go up with them next season and make it a permanent deal. Or if not, or if the fit just isn't right, then maybe try to use that as a stepping stone to somewhere else.
Wow. Okay. So this wouldn't necessarily be a loan to buy opportunity, but
there hasn't been any reporting that that's part of the structure of the deal, but that's not something you could rule out either.
And you have to think that the likelihood, the second that Jordan Morris started playing soccer in Europe, it was going to be the end of his time with the Sounders. Doesn't mean he won't return when he's older or whatever, but like for this time period. And I think
it's a loan. So if things go poorly, if somehow he gets stuck on the bench and people are like, oh, he can't cut it in the championship, then it could hurt his value. And maybe he does end up coming back to the Sounders and, you know, being part of the team by the stretch run of the season. And presumably part of the logic here is that there's, you know, a lot more speculation that the MLS season might be delayed, might start later so that they can try to get more fans in stadia this season.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's definitely an investment. How much do you think this conversation is being led by Jordan Morris versus the team? Is it almost completely Morris?
I mean, they're not getting a lot out of loaning him. They just get out of paying him for that part of the season. So, yeah, I think it definitely seems to be acquiescing to what he wants to do.
Yeah, which they pretty much have to do.
Yeah, and again, if he does play well and increases his value, then, you know, they'll benefit in an eventual transfer.
Wow. Well, I mean, we'll be sad to not see Jordan Morris as a Sounder, but, you know, this was ultimately where he was headed as kind of one of the best young American players. And I think for what it's worth, it's super exciting. And seeing how many young Americans there are playing well in Europe is both exciting for the U.S. men's national team, if that's something that you care about. long-term future. No, I've gotten on board with the MNT. And also, I think it's exciting for MLS itself and kind of demonstrating the talent that MLS can develop to go play in Europe. And for Jordan Morris, you know, having the opportunity to play with, you know, Swansea is not in the EPL at the moment, but Swansea is still a notable club. You know, right. They've been in the EPL for, I think you said, 7 seasons before this. You know, they're a competitor. It's not like...
Almost the entire time I paid attention to the EPL.
Yeah, almost 100%. You know, I think Fiorentina is a better club overall, but the exposure will probably be higher going to a place like Swansea.
That's what he's hoping, I think, in that, you know, the system will be kind of favorable. It's they've put a lot of emphasis on player development is also part of this. So
he really looks like he's more of a British style soccer player than I feel like he is almost any of the other. You know, I see him faring better in England than I do in Germany or Italy.
Quite possibly, yeah. In additional Sounders news, Jeff Reuter of The Athletic reported last week that Federal Way native Kellen Rowe will sign with the Sounders as a free agent. The number 3 pick of the 2012 MLS Super Draft by the New England Revolution was a regular starter for the Revs through 2018, topping out at 7 goals in both 2013 and 2015 with similar numbers of assists. His goal scoring production tailed off starting in 2017, and he has just 2 MLS goals since then. Was a part-time starter for the Revolution last season, starting 10 of the 16 MLS matches he played. I think he profiles as providing depth at midfield, but not a replacement for Jordan Morris. I'd say his more likely role is similar to what we saw from Miguel Ibarra last season. And additionally, the Sounders lost Chris Henderson, who's leaving the Sounders for a role as chief soccer officer and sporting director with Inter Miami. An opportunity for Henderson to run his own soccer organization after serving as number 2 in the Sounders front office behind first Adrian Hanauer and now GM Garth Lagerwey. The Edmonds native has been part of the Sounders organization throughout the franchise's history. So certainly a loss, and we wish Chris Henderson the best of luck in Miami. All right, OL Reign news. Monday was Megan Rapinoe's first competitive match since March. She assisted Sam Mewis on the first of her 3 goals in a 4-0 USWNT win over Colombia. Toast to that. The national team will again play Colombia on Friday. On the Storm front, as we discussed last week, the Storm did decide to place the core designation on center Natasha Howard, guaranteeing her a 1-year offer for the Supermax of $221,450. The team and Howard can still negotiate a longer-term contract, which might be important to giving the Storm more cap flexibility, with Sue Bird and Alicia Clark both also free agents, along with restricted free agent Sammy Whitcomb. So, again, no deals can be finalized. She could accept the qualifying offer now if she wanted to, but no deals besides that can be finalized until February 1st. So that's when free agency will really heat up in the WNBA. Yeah,
and no reason for Natasha Howard to anyway at this point, right?
To just take that deal?
Yeah.
I could see her playing on it, but it's probably not something she'd decide to do today. No.
Yeah, what does she gain by?
Well, I mean, the one thing you gain, I don't know how this would work if the offer was already tendered. We saw some sad news in the WNBA today as Alyssa Thomas, the Connecticut Sun, underwent surgery for an Achilles rupture that she suffered playing overseas, very similar to Brianna Stewart 2 years ago. And she was a free agent. They didn't core her, so she's probably not going to be under contract this year. Ouch. So you do take a risk when you're playing actively during your free agency, and that's one of the many difficult things.
Natasha Howard playing currently?
I think so, although I can't say I've been following it closely.
We found the weakness in your knowledge.
I haven't seen an update on it lately from the Storm's Twitter account. I guess
you're not out there watching like Russian women's basketball.
Well, you know, if the timing wasn't at the same time as college basketball in the NBA, maybe. But it appears from their site that maybe she is not playing overseas at the moment, so then would not have that risk. All right, you know, women's basketball still preparing to come back after a couple of positive tests for COVID-19. We learned on Jody Wynn's weekly radio show last week that the entire UW traveling squad entered a 10-day quarantine on January the 6th after two players returned positive tests. Team currently ramping up activity, but Friday's game at Oregon State was also postponed on Wednesday because they weren't able to have a full contact practice until Wednesday. They are scheduled to return to action on Sunday, traveling to face number 13, Oregon. The Ducks coming off a 57-41 loss to Arizona and our old friend Adia Barnes last weekend in Eugene, which dropped them to number 13 in the latest AP poll. Also learned this week that the Huskies have their January 29th game versus Cal postponed due to a pause for the Cal women after COVID-19 test. You know, men's basketball finally won a Pac-12 game.
I'm shocked. I'm just like reading through the notes and saw that. Wow. I was almost cheering for the zero win season, just to be totally honest. But picking up a victory is definitely something.
It's you feel good for the players who have been working yes. hard and obviously affected by not being able to go out and live their normal lives during the midst of a pandemic. So to get some reward, they beat Colorado 84-80 on Wednesday for their first Pac-12 win. Colorado came in unranked, but number 14 in the Pomeroy rankings, and of course beat the Huskies by 23 in a neutral site game in Las Vegas back in December. Before this, all three of the Buffalo's losses had come to teams in the top 30 of the Pomeroy rankings. It's back-to-back strong performances for the Huskies after a blowout 95-68 loss last Thursday at USC. They led much of the way on Saturday at UCLA before losing 81-76 in that one against the Pac-12's leaders. Huskies showing signs of life on offense. Their three most efficient offensive performances of the season have all come in the past four games, led by different players each time. Going back a couple weeks, Eric Stevenson had 27 points and 6 threes at Cal. Then on Saturday at UCLA, Quade Green had 25 on 10 of 16 shooting. And Wednesday night, it was Marcus Sahonis who had a career-high 27 points to power that victory over Colorado.
Wow.
It sure didn't hurt that the Huskies went 12 of 25 from three, while Colorado went 1 of 18 beyond the arc in that four-point loss. Huskies will try to maintain that momentum Sunday against Utah, which comes in just 2-5 in Pac-12 play, pending their game at Wazoo tomorrow. But one of those two wins came by 14 over UW in Salt Lake City back in early December. But despite the excitement of Wednesday's win, it doesn't look like UW men's basketball season we're going to be following closely into the month of March. And that's why I've unilaterally decided it's time for another installment of Let's Remember a Season.
I saw this in the notes. You told me earlier that there was going to be a new segment. This is your new segment. Also, by the way, you said you were going to defend two unpopular things. Did I cut you off from defending an unpopular take about chicken?
No.
Okay.
We haven't gotten to either unpopular take yet.
Wow. Oh,
they're
God.
Still coming.
I know what one of them is going to be, and you are so wrong about that unpopular take.
Just wait till I make the case. Just wait.
Okay.
Hear me out. So we're going to remember. We're going to go back to a brighter time in UW basketball history. Actually, a time where they were similarly struggling, but then turned things around for the next 10 years or so. And we're going to remember the 2003-04 UW men's basketball season.
Hello. This is the year it all started for Lorenzo Romar and the UW men's basketball program. Before then, they had some positive years under Bob Bender in the 90s and, you know, some success during that time period, but never were really able to turn it into a successful program.
And it wasn't sustained.
I think that this year not only was the first year to put UW men's basketball on the map, including players like Nate Robinson, which would lead to, you know, a first-round draft pick to slam dunk contest victories and that, you know, the entire roster, which kind of became the core of a team that ended up going on to pick up a one seed a few years later in the NCAA tournament. But it also led to the longest sustained period of success for UW men's basketball that they've had in the last 30 to 40 years.
At least 35, yeah. So this was Renzo Romar's second season as head coach, which started with optimism about improvement behind a core of young players from the Seattle area. As you mentioned, Nate Robinson, he'd given up football to focus on basketball in his sophomore year, and Brandon Roy had gotten eligible midway through the 2002-03 season and was now set for a full campaign. They were joined as sophomores by Mike Jensen and Bobby Jones on a roster that featured just one senior, Curtis Allen. The key additions for the Huskies were JC transfers Hakeem Rollins and Trey Simmons from Green River Community College. Huskies started the season 3-0 against low-level competition at home before losing 86-62 to number 17 Gonzaga. Some things never change. And back-to-back road games at Wyoming and Houston. They capped their non-conference schedule with a nice win at San Diego State and a blowout of Columbia. And then Pac-10 play started, and the Huskies could not win a game. They lost both games in the Bay Area by double digits and two closer games at home against the LA schools, including an 86-84 overtime heartbreaker to UCLA. An 84-74 loss at Oregon on January 15th draws the Huskies to 0-5 in conference play. And we're going to really pick up the remembering a season. We're going to go week by week with the Huskies. 2 days later in Corvallis, January 17th, the Huskies trailed by 16 with 6:13 left to play against the Beavers before rallying to force overtime on a Nate Robinson three and winning 103-99 in one of the games that I remember best from my entire life of Husky basketball.
Wow.
You said, I went and re-listened to when we remembered this on Let's Remember Some Years. You said you don't really remember this game at all.
I paid no attention to it.
The famous cousin Katie and I were watching this game together. And I was infuriated because of a player. I asked you this already. Do you remember the player's name now, 8 months later?
Is it Sagarakis?
Angelo Sagarakis, who came off the bench for 18 points and 5 of 10 three-point shooting in this game as Fox Sports, I assume, or wait, was it Root? Yeah, I guess it was Fox Sports at this point. Broadcasters raved about his shooting ability. He finished the season shooting 32% from three.
This is like the most classic Husky story, though. Maybe every other team feels this way. I don't know. But who was it last year against the Huskies who freaking went off?
It was the guy from UCLA.
Oh, God. And he never played well any other time throughout the year.
He did have like one other good game, but yes.
Goes off from three in these, like, just happens to be against UW. I feel like it happens four times every year.
That player was Jake Kyman, who had 21 points on 7 of 12 shooting against the Huskies.
Sometimes it's that pair of brothers, the Thompson brothers from Oregon State, too.
I mean, those are good players, but Stevie Thompson is not necessarily as good a shooter as he shows against the Huskies. He had 21 later in the season against Oregon State, or Arizona State, 20 against Oregon, but no other games where he scored more than 12 points. So Jake Kyman was very up and down.
So tell me about this Oregon State game, though.
Well, we got to talk more about Sagarakis because I did more research this time.
Yes.
So he redshirted the next season due to rotator cuff surgery. Played sparingly his final 2 years at Oregon State before finishing his career at D2 Cal Poly Pomona, and then beginning a long pro career in his native France and Greece. He did not conclude his career until after the 2018-19 season.
Well, good for Sagarakis.
Like, out of all the players in this game, I think only Bobby Jones is probably still playing basketball professionally at this
Bobby
point.
Bobby Jones is still playing professional basketball.
As far as I know, he definitely was when the pandemic struck. He was in Italy last year.
Nice.
I don't know that was nice as it turned out, but
well,
good for him that he's still going.
Basketball.
Yeah.
So this game, I mean, I've told you straight up, if there's going to be a team that I'm going to drop paying attention to, it is Husky basketball. First and foremost, I don't know if it's the time of year or whatever, but like I am the most fair weather of a Husky basketball fan, given that I have not seen, I don't think, a minute of this current team play this year. Maybe I've seen a little bit more, but like I'm finding out the information about these games from you as we're recording a podcast. And that was the case with this particular Husky basketball team. You know, I was all in the Bob Bender era and kind of slowly faded away, probably like a lot of other folks did. And
you were all in the Bob Bender era?
I mean, I was watching every game, you know, for those three seasons or so, right?
I mean, first off, not every game was on television back then. I hate to break it to you.
Every game that I could have. We were hanging on the results of every game in a way. And then I think went to the sporadic game. You were actually a student at UW at this point, and I was not a student at UW yet for this season.
This was my senior year at UW.
But to me, the turning point for UW basketball is the victory at Arizona, which we're going to get to later. Because
home versus Arizona.
That was really when I kind of took note of like, oh crap, there's something happening here. This Oregon State game was like, this was the underground one, right? This is the indie version. This is, you were there before everybody else. And I think that this Oregon State game now has kind of become revered at this point as like the spark of the Lorenzo Roma era. But tell me about what it felt like being there watching this as it was happening, this comeback.
Well, first off, the game was just fucking infuriating because of Sagarax. Like, I wrote a column about him, and I can't remember exactly who the Wizards player was. Oh, it was Jarvis Hayes, had a big game against the Sonics. And I wrote some angry Hoops World column about small Hayes. Sample size performance about those two games that had happened close to each other. Jarvis Hayes also did not go on to a stellar NBA career, as it turned out. But it was
playing
not
in Greece, actually.
It was not a turning point for the Sonics like it was for the Huskies. So you said this when we talked about it in like April, that if we had G-Chat back then, I would have been complaining so much about Sagarakis in our G-Chat.
Were you and Katie living together at the time?
Yes.
Okay.
So we were watching the game together.
You were doing good old-fashioned in-person G-Chat.
IRL.
So you were sitting on your couch in not Wallingford is where you're living, right? I was going to say not Wedgwood. You were sitting on your couch in Wallingford freaking the fuck out about Angelo Sagarakis.
And then everything turns. Nate Robinson hits the three to force overtime, had 25 points off the bench. Will Conroy, 19 points and 6 assists. In a game also, our friend Lamar Hurd had a career-high tying 10 assists in this one with only 2 turnovers. But 0 of 6 shooting in 39 minutes for Lamar Hurd. And like you don't know in the moment that it's a turning point. It's just like, oh, thank God we actually won a game. Like,
similar
that was
to
the
how
emotion.
We're doing this victory over Colorado.
We are pretty confident that the Colorado win is not a turning point because it was clear that the Huskies had a lot of talent that they just hadn't put it together in a way that this year's team doesn't necessarily have that same level of talent. And again, you didn't know it was going to come, but now that we know what happens, now it's clear that it was in fact, a turning point.
Well, I'm excited about getting into the rest of the season. I mean, it's definitely up there with, by the end of it, one of the Husky basketball seasons that I remember the most fondly of any of them ever.
There's some fun moments to come. We didn't really miss out on much, not talking about the first 13 games or whatever it was of that season.
I saw, again, 0 seconds of any of those prior games. And it is kind of funny because I feel like...
I know that's not true because the UCLA game that they lost in OT that I mentioned, I remember we watched that at Grandma and Grandpa's house. It was a family party. We were all there and we watched at least part of that.
Okay. I only remember the UCLA game where Jason Capono played against UW, right? It was like senior day. Wasn't that Capono that we went to?
Yes, Capono was on that team. I mean, more notably... Earl Watson, who is going to be drafted by the Sonics in a couple months.
There we go.
It was his last Pac-10 game. Our UW football news. Defensive coordinator Pete Kwiatkowski is headed to Texas to take the same role under Steve Sarkisian. Kwiatkowski came to UW from Boise State with Chris Peterson as defensive coordinator, then shared co-defensive coordinator title with Jimmy Lake for 2018 and 2019, ceding play calling duties before resuming the sole defensive coordinator role after Lake replaced Peterson as head coach last season.
I've got one response to this that will not come through on audio. And that's right here.
Oh, that's a hook 'em horns.
Wow. Hook 'em horns, baby. We're all Let's in. Go.
We're not. I mean, look, it's hard not to root for a team with Sark and the other Coach K. That's for sure.
I mean, this is shocking news. It felt like Pete Kwiatkowski had to have gotten interest from quite a few schools throughout the country before this. You know, he
referenced that in his interviews talking about it today, that there had been interest in the past and he just wasn't interested in leaving.
And, you know, obviously the money is a big part of it. Going to Texas, the profile, it's one of those jobs that I feel like it'll always be kind of a siren call to certain coaches at Texas, partially because of the money, but you know, you're going to be working with so much talent, you know, you're going to have so much attention on the program. Like the University of Texas it's a unique job in a lot of ways, which is, you know, it's not a cyclical job in the way that some others are. It is always going to be the University of the state of fucking Texas. So I get why that would be of interest. I think working with Sark is in as weirdly an up and coming young coach. Like, that feels weird to say, but I think
Sark is still pretty young.
I think he's pretty poised to be successful. You know, he was fairly successful at UW. He stumbled in hard times at USC, and he's really rejuvenated his career. I think Sark's learned a lot. And he went out there and he took one of the best defensive coordinators in the country from his old school. Like, this is, if we didn't feel so positively about Sark in the Sark Renaissance era of the Pelton cast, I think we'd be upset about it. But it really reads to me more like Pete Kwiatkowski was not treated that well by this university, all things considered, as somebody who is the defensive coordinator who led the program to having a consistently excellent defense year after year after year. He basically got demoted to make Jimmy Lake, you know, to make Jimmy Lake the defensive coordinator.
I mean, by all accounts,
he
was part of this decision. Like, there's a reason he didn't leave. Yeah, Larry when they made
the
Jimmy Pac-12 Lake
parted ways mutually.
He didn't leave when they made Jimmy Lake the co-defensive coordinator. He left after he got the defensive coordinator title back. So I don't think that's what it is. I do think there's an element of...
He hasn't been treated that well. That's all I'm saying.
I think he's been treated fine. He was also the highest paid assistant coach in the Pac-12, if I recall correctly. But he was never going to get the credit here. It was always Coach Pete that got the credit when he was around. And then Jimmy Lake got the credit for the defense, even though the defense was very good before Jimmy Lake was the co-defensive coordinator, when he was strictly a defensive backs coach. And obviously the defensive backs were a huge part of it. I'm not saying Jimmy Lake wasn't involved, but anytime Pete Kwiatkowski has been involved with the UW defense, it's been a good defense.
We may severely regret this loss.
It's possible.
You know, you look at it, and I think there are people who would probably say that Pete Kwiatkowski is more expendable because of Jimmy Lake's experience defensively and because he is a defensive-minded coach as the head coach. But, you know, Pete Kwiatkowski's been that rock the entire time and has coached generation after generation of UW players who have both played well in college, who've developed out of being, you know, you even look at this year, right, with ZTF. Like, this wasn't a player in the secondary who you would give Jimmy the credit for. This was a, you know, pass rushing defensive end and turned into a star player overnight. And I think you have to give Pete Kwiatkowski a lot of credit for that. Like, it makes sense why he would be headed to Texas. So, you know, he was never next in line. He was never, like you said, he was never getting the credit. And I don't blame him for taking this job.
Well, I would never blame him, much as, you know, I wouldn't blame a player for transferring. But yeah, I think it's understandable why he would feel like he could have more control in Texas than he would ever be able to have at UW with a defensive-minded head coach and who came up as the defensive coordinator and get more credit and that sort of thing.
What is the pay like for? Is he one of the highest paid assistants in the country now?
I mean, I don't think we've seen a report on that yet, but it would be surprising if he wasn't. I guess I'd say.
It's funny that we see this information instantly when it's professional teams who are not public institutions, but colleges that are public institutions, including the State College of Texas.
Well, they eventually will have to file the contract. That will be public information when it's like, when it's done.
Come on.
But you don't necessarily have to do it right away.
Okay, let's get to the rest of the UW news before we talk about what this means overall.
Okay. You want to talk about it? All right. Wide receiver Ty Jones announced his transfer to Fresno State, where he'll be reunited with former UW quarterback Jake Haener. Jones spent 4 seasons at UW, but still has up to 2 remaining years of eligibility after redshirting the 2019 season due to injury. And then obviously the 2020 season didn't count as years of eligibility for anyone. His transfer was a bit surprising given he played regularly last season. Only Terrell Bynum had more targets among wide receivers, and then by a narrow 14-13 margin, but may have felt pressure from the younger players in the depth chart or just wanted a chance to, you know, start over somewhere else.
Not great. From, I understand there are other receivers out there, but you know, Ty Jones is definitely somebody who we would have been expecting to be a pretty key wide receiver for UW next season.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely would have. There was would have been a role, so that's why it's a bit surprising. Apparently, I think I saw that he played the most snaps of any wide receiver. Now, obviously, Bynum and Puka Nacua both missed the last game. Due to something involving COVID-19,
whether obvious it was a positive COVID. Test for,
whether it was a positive test for them or contact tracing. So are we going through the rest of the news here?
Let's get to that in 1 second, because I really just feel like it hasn't been great. It's interesting because the Huskies did they didn't play a lot of games. And they had a fine record this season in the games that they did play. But I just feel like if we're looking at the process of what's happening with the program, things are not in a great shape with the football program.
Look, obviously it would have been ideal to keep Pete Kwiatkowski and Ty Jones. The Huskies wanted to do that. Do I think it's going to materially change their outlook for 2021? I don't know that I think that.
Maybe not. I don't know. Pete Kwiatkowski is a big part of it, though. You know, I think
we'll know more about how big a part of it he was after he departs. That's part of what we'll find out. It is different when you have a defensive-minded head coach. It's not exactly Ken Norton, you know, the Seahawks defensive coordinator under Pete Carroll, where he's going to be running Pete's scheme. But there are elements of that. Now, I think the Huskies can and probably will look to save money on the defensive coordinator position and put someone younger in that position to grow into it and rely on Jimmy Lake taking on a little more of those responsibilities.
Yeah, and in as much as I even care about Husky football, I would say that I'm nervous for the program going forward. You know, there was a long time period that under Chris Peterson, you knew that everything was going to be fairly steady. And Jimmy Lake just hasn't earned that yet. And, you know, I think there was some decision making this year that was pretty questionable decision making, and you really wonder about it as far as long term processes. Look, it's something
enough about the Seahawks.
Exactly, it's something that we've seen at that level. And if you're not able to have the decision making right from that position, it's hard to get right. And I just so strongly feel that having offensive minded coaches is better than having a defensive minded coach. You know, I'd much rather have Pete Kwiatkowski. I don't know if I should say that. But if the options were, again, Sark, we always come back to you, Sark.
Well, I'm Sark for coach of everything in Seattle.
The Sounders, OL Reign, Husky football.
Sark for coach of the expansion Sonics.
But if you were to have an offensive-minded coach plus Pete Kwiatkowski, I mean, you'd have to say to yourself, that's a pretty nice tandem. You know, I think the Texas staff right now, you have to feel like it's looking pretty good.
Which it should, because they have all the money.
And they've spent a lot of money to do that, you know?
Is this where we should turn our attention to the last bit of news?
Yes.
The Pac-12 announced Wednesday night that Conference Commissioner Larry Scott and the conference are mutually parting ways as of June 30th. Scott's contract was set to run through June 2022, and the obvious implication here is that they were not interested in extending that contract and decided to instead, the two sides decided to instead end it early.
Is this where you're going to defend Larry Scott?
Yes. I mean, it's a partial defense of Larry Scott. I think a lot of the things that people are upset at Larry Scott about are things that are intrinsic to the Pac-12 and will not change no matter who is commissioner. I'm old enough to remember back to when Tom Hansen was commissioner of the Pac-12, and everyone complained about, oh, none of our games are on national TV. We have terrible exposure. And then, you know what happened under Larry Scott is they went out and got an ESPN deal. They went out and upgraded their Fox Sports deal, and they got more exposure. But then all the games kicked off late at night, and everyone bitched and moaned about that. Well, like, if your desire here is to have all the exposure and have none of the bad game times, that's not an option. That's like, I want all the services, but I want no taxes. These are not, those are mutually exclusive possibilities. So I think that whoever gets this job, people are going to be upset about, because they're going to say, well, why aren't we playing in the college football playoff? Why are Pac-12 teams regarded? Why don't we win national championships in basketball, in men's basketball? And that's not going to change no matter who the fucking commissioner is. That's about the fact that people on the West Coast just don't care about college sports as much as people in other parts of the country.
When did that change, though? Why are you telling me all of a sudden in the last fucking decade, all of a sudden, people on the West Coast stop caring about college sports? But the previous,
this is still the conference
that fucking John Wooden, the Pete Carroll USC era.
You're going to like, John Wooden?
What? Why? If all you're saying to me is that, well, we really went to 0 to 100 on this. If all you're saying to me is that people on the West Coast don't care about college sports the way that people in these other areas of the country do, why then, prior to Larry Scott, prior to the last couple of decades, to be honest, have there been these...
I mean, the last Pac-12 men's basketball champion was Arizona in 98?
But there was still a UCLA team in the early 2000s that went to the Final Four a couple of years in a row. Like, sure. There have been... Pac-12 basketball has become irrelevant under Larry Scott. You can't argue otherwise.
I don't think the correlation football is causation.
So he just happened to oversee the conference as every single team. He's losing to the fucking West Coast Conference. If you want to talk about exposure, right? Like, the West Coast Conference is probably a better basketball conference than the Pac-12. At least at the top has a high... They have a higher ceiling at the top than the Pac-12 does. How
That's
are
one
you not...
school.
Why is that one school not in the Pac-12? It's
because
not even
they,
just
they
one school.
Don't
There's
play
been,
football.
There has
I,
been
I don't know if you're aware that Gonzaga is much smaller school than
from
any of the Pac-12
West Coast
schools.
Conference. Everything that Larry Scott has done in the last decade is wrong.
I mean, obviously, I don't think this is a bad thing for the Pac-12.
Are you kidding me?
The Pac-12 network was a huge miscalculation on their part.
Is it even available on freaking DirecTV in Seattle?
Probably not. And that Larry Scott was paid way too much money, because no commissioner, even if they were like a really good commissioner, is worth that money. And certainly not someone whose track record is as mixed as his is.
I know he was in charge of tennis prior to the Pac-12, right?
Yes, I believe so. I just don't think that whoever's going to come in, you're going to hate them just as much as you hated Larry Scott. That's my position
I'm
at the end of the day.
I'm not thinking about Larry Scott all that much, but I am thinking about how the Pac-12 is completely irrelevant when it comes to basketball. You can't tell me that
the
Pac-12
commissioner is going to change that. I mean, they do have like five teams in the tournament at this point. They're not as bad as it was a couple of years ago.
Now, Larry Scott, not as bad as it was a couple of years ago when I was also commissioner. Pac-12 football, you know, I am probably number one.
Point of it is they have to fucking win the games and recruit the players and invest in the facilities. Like, that's not on the commissioner. That's on the schools themselves and the fan bases.
I don't know why all of the schools in the Pac-12 have gotten bad in the last decade.
The game has changed. Why has Pete Carroll suddenly become a bad coach? Because all of a sudden passing became way better relative to running. And Pete Carroll didn't keep up
the ball. Like, the game changed. And
it's not – you're taking that too literally.
It left the point Pac-12 is, behind. The
yes, the finances of college sports changed dramatically in the past decade and have left the Pac-12 behind.
Why is the Pac-12 not kept up? Is it every individual school has determined that they don't care as much about college sports as schools from the Big 12, the ACC,
the other thing that has changed here is
and
that
the SEC?
All of these cities are made up of transplants in the tech industry.
Every
that's the
single
main
city.
Industry in the West Coast.
It also means that there's so much money in LA, in the Bay Area,
but it's not
in
being
Seattle.
Invested in college sports.
I think you're off base on this one.
Okay, so you think that the next commissioner is going to turn the Pac-12 into a powerhouse in football and men's basketball? That's your position?
Probably not. They are probably not going to turn the Pac-12 into a powerhouse.
Then what are we doing here?
In these sports. But it would be nice to at least be part of the conversation. To not have a basketball conference that is sub the West Coast conference. That's it. The Pac-12 should not be worse than and have less teams going to the playoffs than the Big 12, which almost collapsed as a conference not that long ago. Like, it's not.
I mean,
too
it almost collapsed
ask.
As a conference because of the fact that it was so top heavy. It's not because of
and Larry lack Scott of didn't have the juice to bring over Texas like he should have, and their coach Sark.
I mean, would you really
bring
rather,
Sark
I,
back to the Pac-12?
I think there were some elements where a Pac-16 would have been preferable because of the fact that it ultimately would have become, in most sports, the Pac-8, and that would have been better.
It would have been better. Are you kidding me? Are you? Do you actually think there is a question about whether having Texas as part of the Pacific Coast Conference, whatever we want to call it, would have been worse? Because it would not have been.
I mean, we've had this debate before. My college sports sensibilities run much more towards Tom Hansen.
Oh, God.
Like, I don't think it's a bad thing to not have that much exposure and just be focused on the experience of attending a game. Like, I think that's actually probably more, it cues more closely to the idea of what college athletics should be. That big time revenue sports. You haven't complained once about not paying the players on this conversation. I'm surprised.
Well, I don't think that the commissioner is going to change everything. Like, I don't think that one commissioner for one conference
you don't think
can change
You don't think they're
going
to bring in Ed O'Bannon as the commissioner and just like immediately start paying players?
I'm not naive. Like, I understand how I think eventually teams are going to start paying the players, but I don't think it's going to be the Pac-12.
Teams are not going to start paying the players. They're going to allow them to make money on stuff.
Which kind of makes me, it doesn't make me more upset because it makes me upset that they can't make money from sponsorship. But the fact that they're like, they're going to take a victory lap for the players making money for allowing the players to make money from outside sources is such fucking horseshit. But the fact is, Larry Scott went to the committee that does the college football playoff and said, can we expand to 8 teams for this year? Which is the obvious way to do it. And he got a resounding no from that committee because they don't want the Pac-12 to be a part of it. And at some point you either have to start playing the same game that everybody else is playing or you fucking leave, right? Like, let's come up with something else here. If you're not going to be part of college football as it's being played nationally, start doing something else. Make your own fucking tournament, Larry Scott. Like, this is the reality, is that they're not welcome at the club that everybody else is welcome to within college sports. He got rejected to this proposal, and
we got rejected. He didn't get rejected. We got rejected.
I don't think that the ACC is a worse conference than the Pac-12 in many different ways, right? Do you think that there's more money being invested in ACC schools than Pac-12 schools? We're talking about schools that are in relatively tiny markets, most of them. And
it doesn't matter. The size of the market is not that relevant.
This is the Pac-12. This is the conference that has Los Angeles in it, that has the Bay Area in it, right?
These are all cities that don't care about college sports.
I think you're looking at it too much from the prism of they don't care about college sports right now because college sports have been incredibly bad in these places. Also,
I mean, USC football obviously was a different animal, but I don't know if you're aware of this. The NFL went back to Los Angeles. They put two teams
before
there.
Before those two teams were there, people didn't care about USC. I don't mean to invoke this, but I think we have to blame Stanford for most everything.
Wow. Okay, that's fair. We could all agree on that. Yeah.
Palo Alto, of all places. Come on. Look, if we want to talk about a place that doesn't care about sports, look no further than Stanford.
They cared about college sports when I was there with the Jed Toner family after a game.
I don't think that there's not a history of college sports on the West Coast, though. And
I don't think impressive double negative.
I don't think you could just say in these last two decades. Like, I suppose
there's also a history of Seafair being a really big deal in Seattle.
And it still is. They fucking moved tickets, right? Did they not? They sold tickets to Seafair. The Blue Angels came back. They had butts on the hill for Seafair, right? Sliding right
down.
They
don't televise it anymore. It used to be on all the channels when it started. It was literally all the channels. There was all the channels they had. They only had like three channels.
I think there is a long history of successful college football and college basketball in the Pac-12, and both of those in the last decade have gone away, and they've both gone away under Larry Scott. Like, I just don't know. There's all sorts of other factors to blame here, but at the end of the day, he's the commissioner of the conference, and if the conference got really bad at the two most important things to be good at, then you have to start looking around him. There's a reason that the conference, the collected presidents of these universities, who I assume oversee this, that they decided that they did not want
to... Yeah, they were paying him way too much fucking money.
Exactly.
And he was wasting a lot of money on things that were frivolous. Like, they should absolutely be cutting back, but that doesn't mean things are going to be... that the problems that you have are going to be solved.
I don't expect the commissioner to solve my problems. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm getting on the president for that.
I'm not the type of person who would count on the president, who would count on the commissioner to solve these problems. I think that is a ridiculous way of looking at it. The problems with college football are so much bigger, and college sports in general are so much bigger than the Pac-12 commissioner. These are deep to the core problems that exist with the entire sport. You could have the best fucking commissioner on earth.
Not sport. Concept of amateurism.
Exactly. You could have the best fucking commissioner on earth, and they're not going to fix the issues that exist with college sports. So at the same time, I would still like the Pac-12 to be a relevant conference in basketball and football. That's all I'm asking for. I'm not saying that they have to fix everything.
I would recommend getting to work on that flux capacitor.
Okay, well, you have such a nihilistic view of this. You're just saying it can't be
done. I don't
know
if it even is nihilistic. I don't want the Pac-12 to be relevant, because what it would take for the Pac-12...
You don't want the Pac-12 to be relevant?
What it would take for the Pac-12 to be relevant is to sell their soul.
What does that mean to you?
It would require them to cheat considerably and relax their academic standards.
Why do you care about this? What does an academic standard matter if players are going to university to play sports? Do you actually care about academic standards?
To the extent, I mean, I'm not saying that players should necessarily be disqualified.
These are not students. We know what's going on here.
But I don't think that's the right way to do it.
Oh my God.
That should be a minor league.
We
that
know
be the
that
NBA
that
G League Ignite.
No fucking shit. But you're talking about recreating.
Well, it's going to be in basketball soon.
Well, thank God. But you're talking about recreating the entire system, which, look, I would love to do, but I don't think that's going to happen with a new Pac-12 commissioner. And sometimes you just have to play the sport that everybody else is playing. You need to be Tennessee with the money in the McDonald's bag, right? Like, that's what. The Pac-12 should be doing if everybody else is doing it.
The only winning move is not to play.
No. The only winning move is to pay the players. One way or another. Look, you know what? With your new Pac-12 commissioner, if that commissioner came in and was like, hey, in the Pac-12, we're going to start paying the players. Nowhere else is going to. You know how, A, instantly every single other conference would start to pay the players? And B, if they didn't, how many players would come to the Pac-12? There's your answer right there. That's what I want from a new commissioner. Thank you.
Wow. Okay, you've submitted your resume.
Is that not true, right?
I suppose it's true.
If there was a Pac-12 commissioner who was like, you know what? You could pay me less than Larry Scott, but you know who you should pay is the fucking players, right? And if you want winning sports in the Pac-12, if you want to actually compete at the highest level, you need to do something that the other conferences aren't doing, because competing at on a level playing field with these conferences who are not competing on a level playing field, right? Who are much more comfortable with relaxed guidelines or whatever, right? With underground payments and things like that, with extra facilities, with boosters to the program. You have to do something to level the playing field, and that would be treating your athletes equitably, right? And paying them for what they're doing. You'd either push everybody else to be better as conferences, or you'd have the most talent of any collected conference of all time.
All right, we've all agreed on this.
Great, done, signed.
So now, after that argument, it's time to talk about the Seahawks.
Was that even an argument? I don't even know if it was.
I think it was. Let's talk about the search for a replacement for Brian Schottenheimer, starting with Russell Wilson's reaction.
You said that as if it was like the PeltonCast search for.
I contemplated putting something.
Search for Seattle's next best offensive coordinator.
I considered putting something along those lines in the post about this. Russell Wilson weighed in his postseason media availability. If you're asking me if I was in favor of Shoddy's firing, no, it wasn't my decision to change Shoddy, but I think that Coach Carroll made that decision. I trust his decision. I like, by the way, this is an aside, but I like when people say, I think that things that are inarguably objectively true. Yeah, definitely Coach Carroll made that decision. All right, also from Russ. I think that he's going to be an amazing head or an amazing coach for somebody else, for some other team here soon, hopefully. I think he's going to be a head coach. I think he has that type of leadership ability. Unfortunately for us, I think that in coach's eyes, it was kind of time to see if we could make a change. We were the best offense in football for the first middle part of the season. He was a major part of that. And then Russell Wilson also indicated he wants to be part of the process of finding a replacement. I think it's vital, it's critical, super significant, obviously, that I'm a part of that process. Coach and I have definitely been talking about that, John Schneider too, as well. The next person, whoever that is, it's really critical that we're on the same page at all times and always talking and vibing and really, really on the same page.
So how do you think the conversation is going to go on Seahawks Twitter after Russell Wilson requests a trade?
I mean, it's not going to happen for like a year or two, I don't think. But okay,
you're trusting it'll be a little while?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen like after they hire the offensive coordinator.
Okay, well, what's really important is that you've now, as Pete Carroll, lost a playoff game in the first round, made your franchise quarterback bad on a second half of the season, and also alienated your franchise quarterback, who
I mean, look, they're... He's still very low in the alienated your franchise quarterback in the past week power rankings.
I don't know. There's maybe sitting at number two or three.
He might be number two, but it's a distant number two. Beside that,
this
the Texans,
should,
of course.
The standard should not be the Houston Texans.
I agree with that. All right, so where does the offensive coordinator
what
process
also,
stand?
Those quotes about from Russell Wilson. He doesn't speak that strongly about the things often. And I think that Russ really found a good relationship with Shoddy. And, you know, totally. I think they communicated and they got the offense to the point that both of them felt really comfortable and great about it. And they had the best offense in the league. And I think that Pete Carroll's meddling really threw that off track. And I just, you know, we were talking about, at the end of the year podcast that there really wasn't an enemy, right, for this offseason. We've had, you know, 2 years ago, the post the Cowboys loss, we said to ourselves, they need to let Russ pass more. And, you know, I think in the Packers loss last year, just like the defense has to get better, right? And this year is like, well, the defense played pretty well in the second half of the season and the offense fell apart or whatever. And we're just like, we can't really pinpoint why. And then Pete Carroll over the next fucking week was just like, oh yeah, I'm why. Hey, the defense got bad. Blame me right here. It was my fault. I actually am proud of the defense being bad.
I mean, it was like people have used this in another context about the Seahawks in the second half of the season, but it was the hot dog meme.
He took a victory lap basically after this year was over for the offense becoming horseshit halfway through the year. Like, I just can't even fathom the self-awareness to be like, I stepped in and corrected some things and made the offense fucking awful, right? Like, even the eye test, no matter how you judge things, I suppose aside from quarterback wins over the second half of the year, if you highly value victories over the Washington football team and the New York Jets.
You're not going to do this list like five times again this week,
but like, it just, Pete Carroll stepped up and said, hey, it was my fault. I did this. And then also that star quarterback who was playing at an MVP level for the first 8 weeks or whatever. Oh yeah, I made them angry after the year two by firing the offensive coordinator that they didn't want to fire. Like, what are we doing here?
Well,
he's,
I mean,
he's saying the quiet parts out loud.
From a big picture perspective, the issue we have is that the Seahawks are operating as if the most important person in the Seahawks organization is Pete Carroll, even though the most important person in the Seahawks organization is, in fact, Russell Wilson.
Now, I will say, every organization, not every organization, the people who have the ability to make decisions have the ability to make decisions until they don't. And, you know, look, Deshaun Watson outlasted Bill O'Brien with the Houston Texans. Bill O'Brien was still able to trade DeAndre Hopkins before the year, right?
Well, but the question is whether he's going to outlast Bill O'Brien. The question is whether he's going to outlast the owner.
Well, I think the owner is going to outlast. It's whether, what is the dude's name? Easterbrook or whatever? The like youth pastor dude who's on staff for the Houston Texans. Look,
Jack Easterby. Yes.
There are worse scenarios out there, but that's looking at literally the worst scenario. So I agree with you that an issue is that the Seahawks are treating Pete Carroll as if he's the most important person in the franchise. It's kind of the way it goes in the NFL, though. You know, when you give decision makers the ability to make decisions, they're going to do that. And it's a wherewithal that they need to have because there's never going to be an organization who's just like, yeah, we've given up all decision making to the quarterback. Look, everybody knows they're more important than the fucking coach.
You don't say that out loud. Again, that's the quiet part you say behind it. You whisper. Look, the issue here is
Tom
it hasn't
Brady
come.
Tom Brady is not the coach or is not the quarterback of the New England Patriots. Bill Belichick is still the coach, and Tom Brady is playing in a conference championship game this year. And the Patriots had their worst season of Bill Belichick being their head coach. Like, this is not a unique thing to the Seahawks.
I mean, the thing is, it hasn't yet come to a head because Russell Wilson might have had like some passive aggressive comments about this in his press conference, but he hasn't posted, you know, tweets about going from 2 to 10 or whatever it was that Deshaun
Watson.
They've
been good, right?
Yeah, like, and maybe it'll all work out in the end that they'll find someone that everyone can agree on as offensive coordinator. But they're taking a
narrator voice. It didn't.
No, I think you were going to be. Does it ever work for anyone? No, they just delude themselves into thinking it will work for them. But it might work for us.
Oh, God.
So let's talk about the process of hiring a new offensive coordinator, where it stands. In last week's emergency pod, I focused on non-coordinators in line for a promotion. Didn't really consider the possibility of the Seahawks hiring a former head coach, but it does sound like that's a consideration they are exploring. They have reportedly in the past week talked to Anthony Lynn, Snohomish native Doug Peterson, and Adam Gase, all of whom were offensive coordinators before becoming head coaches and being fired at the end of the season. Peterson told Les Bowen of the Philadelphia Inquirer Wednesday that he's leaning toward taking the year off, so it doesn't sound like he's going to be an option.
Okay. Well, we'll see.
And now I'm going to move my second defensive and unpopular thing. Why I don't think it's a big deal the Seahawks talked to Adam Gase, which I feel like we kind of missed out on because you and I, your family and I and Jan, we went to the beach on Monday and we're socially distanced, wearing masks outside, walking along the beach. Well, the Adam Gase news broke, and we missed Seahawks Twitter flipping the fuck out while we were gone.
Okay, let's hear your defense here. You will defend any decision that anybody makes.
So my defense, you did
the same thing defending Shoddy too, which maybe you were right in the end. I don't know.
Look, now Shoddy looks like the hero.
He's going to be our new Sark.
Well, first off, I hope that Daryl Bevel is our new Sark. We haven't heard enough talk about Daryl Bevel as a candidate for this job. I don't think that if the Seahawks hire Adam Gase, it is obviously a disaster. My defense is of them talking to Adam Gase, because one of the things we've talked about on this podcast repeatedly is having seen to some extent the inner working of organizations, this whole idea that, nobody from the outside gets it because there's all these things that are happening on the inside that we know about that you don't know about on the outside. Most of the time it's bullshit. It's just people talking themselves into bad decisions. But there is an exception, and there are a few exceptions. And one of those is that sometimes there are things that you do because you are trying to keep other people happy, specifically agents. And I think it is entirely possible that part of the reason the Seahawks are talking to Adam Gase is because, I have no idea who his agent is, but that agent might control someone else they actually want to talk to because they actually want to hire. And it looks good if Adam Gase is seen talking to a team, because look, Adam Gase is still in the mix for offensive coordinator jobs, despite having overseen one of the most disastrous franchises, maybe two of the most disastrous franchises in recent NFL memory in his last two jobs. It doesn't mean anything for them to just talk to Adam Gase.
Kevin Pelton's column in the New York Times, in defense of interviewing the pedigreed white male. Like, are you kidding me? You made up this idea that Adam Gase's agent also works with somebody that they want to work with, and that's your defense of interviewing Adam Gase?
I don't even know that they interviewed him. They talked to him.
Not even a bad offensive coach, right? And has proven himself.
Gase is at CAA, so I imagine he must share his agency with many potential coaches.
I'm sure that he does, but like, look, the coaches who the Seahawks want to interview. I'm gonna tell a personal story here, and that is an artist that I work with had options to work with two different agents, right, at two different agencies. And they weighed beforehand. They were like, well, the agent that we want to work with has a smaller roster than another agent who wants to work with us, who has a bigger roster of artists that are really similar to what we do. And they were like, are we still going to get offers to tour with the bands of the agent who works with a larger number of groups? And it's like, you're going to be fine. You know what I mean? You're the commodity, right? Like, the band is the commodity. And also, the artists that company works with are going to want to work with you, and you do not have to worry, right? They are still that agency that you have shirked or whatever you passed on is going to send you tour support offers as those artists want to take you out on tour. It's not up to the fucking agents. The agents don't actually matter all that much. And you know what? We got a tour support offer from the other agency within like a month in the middle of a pandemic when shows aren't even happening. So I do not buy this at all. He's at CAA. Everybody's at CAA. Like, come on.
It works differently in sports. Like, summer league rosters are built based on like favors to agents.
Great, because summer league rosters don't fucking matter.
Neither do talking to Adam Gase. It only matters who they fucking hire.
I agree that it only matters who they hire, but I think your threat level is way too low here for them interviewing Adam Gase. And my issue with Adam Gase is not just that Adam Gase seems to be a bad offensive coach. My issue with Adam Gase is that he seems to be a fucking asshole. Every single time you hear about Adam Gase as a person, it is something like Adam Gase has alienated every single person around him and nobody likes him.
Including Jamal Adams.
The issue. And I don't think you're grasping, like, sometimes this looks bad for an organization to...
I don't think Jimmy Gase... I don't think that anyone's going to remember that they talked to Adam Gase when they actually hire an offensive coordinator. This is one of those things that in the moment seems like such a big deal. It's like when they who they're going to keep is the 53rd man on the roster, and then 2 weeks later they've rotated out like five players from the back end of the roster, and no one cares then because there are games
like
going on.
It's a serious enough issue that they might hire Adam Gase. We might be here in a week talking about Adam Gase, Seahawks offensive coordinator.
If they hire Adam Gase, we'll have so much time to be upset about it. I don't need to be upset about it before it happens. I'm in no hurry. I'm not going to run out of time to be upset about them hiring Adam Gase if they hire Adam Gase.
You know that it's coming.
Fine.
I don't think we need to defend. We don't need to defend this before it happens.
By the way, I will bet you they do not hire Adam Gase.
I mean, you can bet that they're not going to hire any individual one random person, right? Well, you would always take the field versus one individual.
I give you odds.
I did some pretty high odds here.
Well, then what are we doing here? What odds do you need?
20-1.
See, there's a 5% chance you think that they hire Adam Gase?
I don't know. Maybe it's less.
Okay, so you're talking yourself into lower odds. All right. We'll conclude this bet offline.
Oh, God. I do think that, you know, the Doug Peterson news is sad because I think that Doug Peterson would be an upgrade over Shoddy as an offensive coordinator. And
to
I
me,
think
the biggest thing is that Doug Peterson would come in with a certain gravitas of having won a Super Bowl as a head coach. That
the same amount of Super Bowls as Pete Carroll's won.
Yes. That would potentially give him more leverage in some of the decision-making processes than, you know, if they hire some quarterback coach.
Which is probably the reason that Pete's not going to hire Doug Peterson. But I think Anthony Lynn is somebody else who, look, if Anthony Lynn is the next offensive coordinator, that's an upgrade. You know, I think that
we're going to run the ball a lot if they hire Anthony Lynn.
They're going to run the ball a lot no matter who they hire.
Like,
Anthony Lynn is, I think that Russell Wilson would probably get along with Anthony Lynn. I think that Anthony Lynn has proven to be able to lead good offenses and has had some degree of creativity with that.
And I think people get kind of hung up on how these coordinators do as head coaches. And that's why Adam Gase deserves a second. No, no.
Oh, God.
No. But like,
who
the
was
problem
he? He was the Dolphins coach.
He was the Broncos offensive coordinator one of the years under Peyton Manning. And then I believe maybe the Bears, he might have followed John Fox there briefly.
Okay.
Before he got the Dolphins job.
He managed to turn Peyton Manning into a good quarterback.
Yeah, but basically that's why he got the job, because he worked with Peyton Manning. It was like he worked with Sean McVay one time. I would not be unhappy about them hiring Anthony Lynn, although I would have some concerns about it. Another change since last week is some of the offensive coordinators we expected to get head coaching jobs haven't yet, which could mean the possibility of hiring the QB coaches who were in line to replace them. Aaron Wilson of the Houston Chronicle reported that Bills offensive coordinator Brian Daboll will stay with the team after the Chargers instead hired Rams defensive coordinator Brandon Staley, which a toast to getting Brandon Staley out of the NFC West.
What? It doesn't fucking matter. I mean, it's yes, still I agree. No, Brandon Staley, he cooked Shoddy or Pete Carroll in that playoff game. Brandon Staley, seeing the Rams secondary, look, the Rams have a lot of talent defensively, and the same thing did not happen to the Rams against Matt LaFleur. To a real offensive coach, all of a sudden the Rams defense was not so scary. And I will say an offensive line like the Packers, but seeing that Rams secondary by the third time that they played the Seahawks, they knew exactly what the Seahawks were doing. And you have to give Brandon Staley credit. It's a terrible decision, of course, to hire a defensive coach as your head coach. And if you have Brian Daboll out there, who is, I think you have two of the most impressive offensive coordinators that I've ever seen in my entire life out there on the market looking for head coaching jobs at the moment. So if you're going to hire like a 30-year-old wunderkind defensive coach, I personally don't agree with that decision process-wise, but better luck to you.
Dable did not exactly confirm that he would definitely stay in his media availability earlier this week, but Ken Dorsey is Buffalo's quarterback coach. We're also down now to two open jobs, the Eagles and the Texans, for Chiefs offensive coordinator Eric Bieniemy, the other surely offensive coordinator you're referring to. The Seahawks have been reported to have interest in their quarterback coach Mike Kafka, though Jason LaCanfora of CBS Sports reported on Monday that Kafka would stay with the Chiefs.
Versus being the offensive coordinator for the Seahawks?
He actually interviewed for the Eagles head coaching job, so we'll see what's in store for Kafka.
Mike Kafka gets a head coaching job
ahead of Eric Bieniemy,
I'm done paying attention to football. Yeah,
That would be fair. I think he pulled out of this search to the extent that he was ever a part of that. Also, the Seahawks will not, sadly, be getting a LaFleur, as Mike LaFleur is following Robert Saleh from the 49ers to the Jets as their new offensive coordinator. They also promoted Mike Daniels, who was one of them was, I believe he was the run game coordinator and LaFleur was the pass game coordinator. They promoted Daniels to offensive coordinator in San Francisco after LaFleur's departure.
Adam Gase's 1 year as an offensive coordinator that did not involve Peyton Manning was with the Chicago Bears in 2015. And they went 6-10.
But what did they finish in offensive DVOA?
You're going to have to pull that up. Their offensive DVOA. They scored the 23rd most points in the league of anybody.
This was 2015?
Yes, the 2015 season.
You're going to have to log in again.
I'm going to guess it was bottom third. Or it was at least sub 20.
I mean, I think that's almost certainly the case. Chicago. Wow. Okay. I am flummoxed. They finished 10th in offensive DVOA in 2015.
Really? Well, there you go.
Let's hire Adam Gase. Let's not hire Adam Gase. Another candidate, Ian Rappaport of NFL Network reported that the Seahawks will interview Las Vegas Raiders running back coach Kirby Wilson, who is the running back coach under Pete Carroll with the Patriots and also part of his first USC staff as wide receiver coach before returning to the NFL and working for a number of teams in that running back coach role.
Okay.
So.
I mean, that was a long time ago that Pete Carroll was with the Patriots. That is a blast in the past. It's gonna end poorly for us. Pep Hamilton seems to have had a little bit of steam.
He's definitely gotten a lot of mention, yeah.
Who, you know, I've always been a pretty anti-Pep Hamilton kind of guy, dating back to the days that he destroyed the entire Pac-12 at Stanford.
Pep Hamilton definitely has a great fondness for running the football that would seem to make him a good fit for Pete Carroll in Pete Carroll's mind.
Having legendary style quarterbacks and then having them hand the ball off is kind of Pep Hamilton's signature move. And, you know, maybe you could carry that over to the NFL. It's going to be bad. Whatever it is, it's going to be bad.
I can't see how I feel any better about the decision to move on from Brian Schottenheimer with a few days additional reporting.
If the conversation is, if Doug Peterson was the offensive coordinator, if Anthony Lynn was the offensive coordinator, I think it was the right decision. There are better options out there. Whether Pete Carroll is going to make those better decisions, of course, without any input from Russell Wilson, clearly. If he's going to make those better decisions remains to be seen. And I think when you're looking at this decision, which is a combination of alienating your star quarterback plus bringing in somebody else, that's when it becomes a little bit more complicated. Is the value of the next offensive coordinator worth alienating your star quarterback or even worth just, you know, having a change of pace or whatever? Because, you know, I think the offense got better probably statistically under Shoddy, at least in the last couple of years, and Shoddy and Russ got really close over time. The reality is, whomever the next coordinator is, they're going to get really close with Russell Wilson because he's the entire fucking offense. And if you're the offensive coordinator, you're going to get close with Russell Wilson. So all of a sudden you might start seeing things the way of, well, you know, in the first 8 weeks of the season, we had the best offense in the NFL and I was an MVP candidate. Maybe let's try to create some of that.
Yep.
This has become, Pete Carroll has moved from being a kind of fun annoyance for the Seahawks to borderline villain.
In certain circles, yes.
Do you not agree with that, though?
I mean, villain is strong.
It's and maybe this is part of just, as I talked about in the end of your podcast, maybe this is a grass is greener thing. You know, the chances of the next coach being better than Pete Carroll are not 100%. We can't just be like, well, they could hire Eric Bieniemy. They could hire Brian Daboll. They could have had a Matt LaFleur type, right?
They'd probably end up hiring, Matt Campbell? Dan Campbell?
Adam Gase.
Well.
Like, there are other options that are worse. So we know that Pete Carroll is good at some things. And I think that
he's very good at some important things. I mean, there was a good discussion about it. I posted about this on Twitter. The Seahawks Man to Man podcast had Ben Baldwin on, our longtime third Pelton brother. And they had a good conversation about it. And, you know, both Mike and Chris ended up in the conclusion that the Seahawks were better off keeping Pete than firing him. And I don't agree with that at this point. I think you know where he ended up. I don't agree with that at this point, but I don't think it's like a preposterous position to take.
Do you think that, let's say that the average replacement coach is better than Pete Carroll?
I think at this point, yes, in as much as even the average coach would orient the team more around Russell Wilson.
Let's look at who are the coaches who've been hired so far this year. And how many of them do you think would orient the team more or less around Russell Wilson?
Well, I mean, the crop that's been hired so far, I certainly wouldn't feel better again about Dan Campbell as my head coach.
That was like who they hired. That was a wild one.
Saleh and Staley, you know,
defensive coaches,
both defensive coaches, but both younger and have been exposed to more progressive offensive philosophies where they've been. So that's, you know, encouraging. I feel like they're like, I could go either way on that one. Arthur Smith, I think, would bring a better offense to the Seahawks.
You can't confidently say about Saleh or Staley. I agree that I think that they probably would. I love the idea of being exposed where it's like they've been to a house party before and they've seen a rave.
They've seen a play action.
I mean, both of them they've been on the opposite side of good offensive coaches, so they probably know what that looks like. Each of them was Staley with the Rams in a lower position when they went to the Super Bowl?
No, he just arrived this past offseason. He was previously in Denver and Chicago.
Oh, he was in Denver. I thought he was in Baltimore. Okay, so
he was under Vic Fangio.
Okay. And then Arthur Smith.
Arthur Smith, I think, would be a better coach.
Absolutely.
And I'm missing, Urban Meyer. I'd probably rather have Pete than Urban Meyer.
Really kind of feels like it'd be about the same. you kind of don't know. There's a bit of a cult of personality around both Urban Meyer and Pete Carroll.
But Pete has at least proven that he can be a winning NFL head coach, and we don't know that yet about Urban Meyer. So.
Okay, let me just throw out a theory for you that I just came up with. I fucking love it. Which is offensive coaches, coordinators in particular, tend to go farther in the playoffs because offense is more important than defense. Therefore, they are hired for head coaching positions less than their defensive counterparts.
I mean, I feel like this is kind of a recent thing. This like, oh, we can't possibly hire this coach because they've gone too far in the playoffs for us to interview them. Yeah. I mean, that didn't stop teams from hiring, you know, Dan Quinn. I think Dan Quinn got hired after the Seahawks went to the Super Bowl, didn't he?
It's to justify racism. But okay, well, yes.
Brian Daboll is not being affected by racism. I do think there is a legitimate element where, paradoxically, the best thing you can do as a coordinator is lose in the second round.
But This is a perfect theory, right? Good offensive coordinators for the best offenses in the NFL, right? Look up you have DVOA still up. Are you signed in?
I am signed in. I don't know if I left that page, though.
Where do the Packers, the Bills, and the Chiefs rank in offensive DVOA? Because it has to be pretty high.
It's very high, yes. The Packers are number one.
Uh-huh.
The Bills are number five.
Uh-huh.
The Buccaneers are number three, and the Chiefs are number two. So it's four of the top five defenses, the offenses by DVOA.
I hate you, Pete Carroll. And also, these are, I don't even know who the Packers offensive coordinator is, but, you know.
I mean, it's LaFleur's offense.
Matt LaFleur is getting all that credit, which that's too tight. He was the Titans coordinator, right?
He was the Titans coordinator when they had Marcus Mariota.
But the two Titans coordinator, offensive coordinators getting head coaching jobs within
3 years?
3 years.
Yes, yes, that is correct.
Which is pretty funny because their offense hasn't been that good.
You know who the top five team that in offensive DVOA that isn't in
the other team.
Championship game is it?
I'm right? obviously pro the Titans offense. And feel like Arthur Smith is a great play. But like two of those coaches are not our offensive. Two of those teams have hot names as offensive coordinators who there's a very good chance they're not going to get jobs. And that is, it's like, I guess it's not an oxymoron. I suppose it's irony, right? Okay.
It's a catch 22 is what you're looking for.
It's not a catch 22. It is the classic definition of irony, right? If irony is when the expected outcome is different than the actual outcome, the expected outcome is that the teams who have the best offenses play far into the playoffs. The expected outcome would be that those coaches would get jobs, but the actual outcome is you hired Dan Campbell.
Well, there's still two open jobs, so we'll see who gets those two jobs. Hopefully, Eric Bieniemy will get one of them.
If Eric Bieniemy doesn't get a job, the NFL has a deeper problem than.
The NFL has a deeper problem, but hopefully, Eric Bieniemy will get a job anyway.
Hopefully, Eric Bieniemy will get a job, and Brian Daboll has been ridiculously impressive.
All right, let's wrap up with some other disappointing news, which is that Josh Gordon's conditional reinstatement was officially rescinded by the NFL. Of course, because of the NFL's transparency about this matter, we know exactly why this happened and understand that it is an understandable decision, but still certainly a huge disappointment.
Yeah, we don't know enough about this to really speak on it. Which is unfortunate, and I think most importantly, you hope that Josh Gordon is not being punished by the NFL for minor drug offenses, which feels like it's probably the case. And I'd feel bad personally for Josh Gordon, not as a Seahawk, right? As I don't care what team he's playing for, right? I want Josh Gordon to be in the NFL. And I think that the safest place for him is in the NFL, I think probably in a lot of ways. And the NFL litigating the legal system that's not what the NFL is. It's not a legal system, right?
I mean, I would be careful with this opinion because now you're arguing that the NFL shouldn't punish players for example, domestic violence. And other situations where the legal system often falls short. Now, you know, a drug that is legal in much of the country is a different situation entirely. But as we've noted in the past, Josh Gordon's most recent suspension from the NFL was not strictly about marijuana. It was also about performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah. Again, we just don't know enough about it.
And that's where you wish there was a level of transparency that sadly does not exist with the NFL.
But I feel bad for Josh Gordon as an individual.
Yeah. hope that we can see him back on the NFL football field at some point, whether it's in Seattle or somewhere else. All right. Well, on that happy note, thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned next week. We didn't mention, by the way, the Talkin' Taco. Oh, we did mention the Talkin' Taco time, did we? I guess, yeah. But be sure to check that out. And stay tuned next week. We've got something pretty exciting in the works that we hope you're going to enjoy. So,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Another classic.